We are reading in Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother, and we've reached page 319. We are still following the journey, the sadhana of King Asvapati, who will become the human father of Savitri. We've been following him for a long time now, exploring all the planes of existence, the worlds. But now he has moved beyond the borders of the manifestation. He has, in his consciousness, in the previous canto, he had a very powerful sense of the mother's presence enveloping him, penetrating him, and through that he came to a knowledge of who she is and what is her work and her blessing. His inner response to that was a widening, a kind of transformation of the aspiration that has led him on all this great journey. He had started out with the will to find the power that could bring those high, powerful spiritual experiences he was having in trance, that could bring those experiences into life. This was the power that he was looking for. And now that he has found her, found it, that the mother carries that power in her. She is that power and consciousness which can bring about the change. The only yearning left is to bring her presence and her power down into the world for earth and men. We saw at the beginning of this canto that he realizes that a mightier task remained than all he had done. And he's expecting further experiences to come, but at first nothing happens. Last week we read about this, no? How the heavens seem to be closed. And when he looks into himself, he feels the resistance. There's something in the very substance of humanity that says no, that doesn't want to change, that doesn't want to receive the transforming power of the mother. So he has to deal with that in himself. And we read about how, in order to change, to reject this element out of himself, out of his very substance, he tore desire up from its bleeding roots and offered to the gods the vacant place. And this supreme act of renunciation brings about a last and mightiest transformation. In the course of his sadhana, he's passed through several transforming experiences that affected not only his consciousness, but also his nature being, his life, mind, soul. Now his soul comes in front like a great sea, flooding the mind and body with its waves. And his being widens to embrace the universe. It is able to unite the within, the subjective experience, with the objective world, the universe outside, to make of life a cosmic harmony. So now we are reading on page 319. We came to line 77, which says, "Overpowered were form and memory's limiting line." We are reading about the effects of this last and mightiest transformation that came to him. Franz, would you start? Page 319, about 10 lines from the top. Overpowered were form.
Overpowered were form and memory's limiting line.
Yes, that's veiling from us the supreme experience. Maybe we can even think it is this highest form of mind that's called a golden lid in the Upanishads, no? That has to be removed to give the supreme experience. Mm.
How do we know what you make it?
Yes, of course, it's not something that we in our present state can aspire for. Aswapati's gone through a very long and complex sadhana to come to this point. This is the last and mightiest transformation. But, yeah. His soul was a delegation of the all. Yeah. All this is his self-experience. No? And now with this last and mightiest transformation, there's no more mind. There's no more separation of any kind. No? There's no barrier between world and God. No? And the circle of the little self, so his sense of self-existence has just got dissolved. So what about the soul? There's still an individual soul there, but he experiences it as a representative of the all, of that which is all the manifestation. And it's turned away from its eternal, it's turned away from itself, from its form in the universe, to join the One Supreme. So it's an experience on of the union with the Supreme Consciousness. And this is happening not only in consciousness, this is happening in nature. He experiences all his life parts, his body, the life, the mind, as a movement of the all of the universe, which is exploring itself to find that everything is himself, is his highest self. Yes, it refers to the Supreme. Yes.
How many souls are in India?
There's only one. Yeah. Yes.
What was that again?
There's a little anecdote that in the West, and particularly in the end of the 19th century, there was this questioning about how many souls are there, and who has a soul, and do animals have souls? So when Paul Richard returned to Paris from India, Mother recounts that some devout old lady asked him, "In India, do they count the souls?" Mm-hmm. And he replied, "Yes." And she said, "How many? How many there are?" Mm-hmm. "Only one. It's one soul. Mm-hmm. The one who is all." Those of you who read my last year's lecture on this part of Savitri might remember that I mentioned there are some letters of Sri Aurobindo, little notes, when he was sending the text to Amalkiran for typing, in which he mentioned his intentions, where he's going with this part one of the poem. And when he came to the part that has now become book three, he said it will deal first with the unknowable and then with the Purushottama and then with the Divine Mother. So I had to do a little bit of research to find out what Sri Aurobindo meant by this term, Purushottama. It's the term that's used in the Gita for the Supreme Being. And I found that among his letters he'd been asked some questions about Purushottama. Can one become the Purushottama? So he said, "I don't think so, but it is possible for a human being by surrender and oneness to experience and live in the Purushottama consciousness." So then I had to look in book three, where is that described? And I think it is in this section here. After this last and mightiest transformation, he's living in union with that one supreme consciousness, and even his nature is taken up by that consciousness. And it's as a result of that this experience which happens in the house of the spirit in this section, that in the rest of the canto he's able to see the possibility of the new creation. And then in the last canto we have his dialogue, his conversation with the Supreme Divine Mother and her granting of the boon. That is how I am understanding this passage here. There's no separate being anymore. He's living in the...
is the mighty beating of the heart?
The heart beats. So that's typical for us. Well, it's true. No, if our heart doesn't beat, we wouldn't be alive anymore. So his life processes seem to have been transformed. So that heart that once was a kind of barrier to the experience of the supreme inviolable, this becomes so much more powerful with this transformation of the nature. It has the mighty life force of an immortal being, a divine being.
The very last line that was just read, and bright remoteness gleamed near, and kin.
Kin are our close relations.
Yes.
So Sri Aurobindo is always telling us that those beings and experiences on the higher levels, they are actually very closely related to us. And now he is experiencing that, these bright remotenesses, these far distant states of being and consciousness that have seemed very, very far away. Now they come very, very close to him, and he feels an intimate relationship and connection with them.
Making it sound like a verb, which is not.
No, it's parallel to the near. Near, they leaned near, and they showed their kinship. It's a kind of poetical compression of the language. Revealed their kinship.
It looks like the symbol in the two sentences, awaiting the ascent and awaiting the descent.
Yes.
The symbol of Aurobindo.
Yes.
The ascending triangle and the descent.
Yes.
He's experiencing what Aurobindo wanted to tell us.
Yes, and I think this is, we can say this experience is, or this description is based on Sri Aurobindo's own experience. So he knows he has to go higher, but he's expecting also that there will be a descent of transforming force to bring about change here in the world. Yeah. Yes. And he sees the earth in its significance as a splendor and a symbol. And he sees these serene epiphanies, revelations of divine presences. They are looking at him. And these sacred vasts. Sometimes we think that the vastnesses are empty, but these are sacred vasts, hallowed vasts, are surrounding blessing. Infinitudes. This is a word that Sri Aurobindo has invented. He's coined it and introduced it into the English language. But we can understand what it means. No? Instead of saying infinitenesses, this sounds much more poetic. Full of wisdom, full of truth knowledge. They are very, very close. He feels intimately close to all these highest states. Yes, so that's what he's doing now. Yes. Yeah.
What is hallowed?
Hallowed. Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. It means sacred, actually. What is hallowed is sacred, blessed. We have Halloween, All Hallows' Eve. It is the evening of the souls, all the saints and all the souls.
Mm.
I suppose the next day must be All Saints' Day. Inviolable. If you violate something, you attack it, you spoil it, you damage it in some way. That Supreme Being is inviolable. There's no way in which it can be wounded or made imperfect in any way. I think there's a line in Isha Upanishad which describes the Supreme Being, and there are these many different Sanskrit words describing him, and this inviolable must correspond to one of them. You could have a look if you have a knowledge of Sanskrit. Yes. I think there, maybe in the Isha Upanishad, he translates it unwounded. But here it's unwoundable. There's no way that it can be wounded. Lucency means the quality of light. So there's so much light, a tremendous lucency there, that has an effect first on the senses, all the senses by which we normally relate to what is outside us. This failed, stops working. It's not needed anymore because there's this subjective closeness. So the hearing fails. These ephemeral voices, all the voices of the world, all the transient voices of the universe, they fell away. And the very power of thought, it's such a beautiful image. The capacity for thought, it has no more power, and it sinks. Something large and pale, sinking like a tired god into mysterious seas. It just vanishes into that tremendous lucency. So all those robes and coverings of mortal thinking are cast down, leaving his knowledge, Asvapati's knowledge, naked, uncovered, to absolute sight. The sense of that driving of fate, of what is predestined, what has to be fulfilled, pressure of the movement of time ceased. That spur, poking, which is always driving us forward so that we really cannot rest. No? This for him now ceased. The will, he has such a powerful will, in a way that's what he represents, the power of will. And the will, Sri Aurobindo says, is like an athlete who trains and practices with a lot of effort. Heavings, that's what you do when your breath does, when you make a lot of effort. So that all that effort of the will becomes still in that unmoving peace of the all-powerful. The all-powerful can achieve everything without any effort. in total peace.
This is really the history of this huge work he has done in this state of trance to the Savitri.
Yes, all the other books,
and
yes.
You cannot do something like that in a mind which is not still under
yes.
such a state.
Yes.
In
this stillness. Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but when we speak to her, could you speak in voice loud enough
okay,
that we all
can hear? I'm sorry.
So she's saying that this unmoving peace, that this reminds her of Sri Aurobindo and all that he has done, the writings and everything else that he has done, he must have done it from this state of unmoving peace. Otherwise, it's simply not possible. So the life force also, it's always under a state of tension and driving, no? That also the life in his members, in his body, lay down, vast and mute, silent. It's uncovered, it's naked, it's unwalled, no limits. It bears the immense regard, that huge look of immortality. And it's not terrified to feel that the look of that immortal state. And everything becomes silent. The last movement of nature grew still. And he feels a pressure, a weight, that is the hand of the transcendent. It's not seen, it's felt as a pressure that's laid on his body, on his limbs. Sealing them up, silencing them, protecting them, quietening them, and then he can move into another state of consciousness. Infinity swallowed him into shoreless trance. Here the awareness of the body is taken away, and he moves into another state. Yes, I love this picture.
The idea of, you know, the old religions God.
Yes.
Tired.
We've had enough now.
Yes.
He's done his work. No? Yes. And in classical art, there are pictures now of the rivers. There's this flow of their river, and there is the form of the god. So one can imagine him just giving up and sinking, dissolving himself into that flow of the eternal. Yes, Marco. Yes. Yeah.
It is unterrified, because unterrified brings us back to some other moment in the experience of the of the king,
yes.
In which part of the body or the spirit of the mind or whatever were really terrified to disappear into this.
Yes.
But now we are in a different.
Yes, and that's of course Sri Aurobindo's problem. How is he going to convey to us, how to give us a glimpse of these things that are really indescribable? And so he has to resort to these negatives. But I also noticed this unterrified, because I know that many, 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 many years ago I had some kind of an experience of that eternal vastness. And something in me was absolutely terrified. It just rushed back into the body and locked the door. And I must say, I've never been able to open it since. No.
So,
Yes, I'm sure it will come at the right moment. But I was just in my early teens at that time, and I was very fascinated with the idea of going beyond time and space. And well, I know that there's some part of me that can experience that. Yes, for sure. Yes.
Is your consciousness somewhere has this memory or this possibility, and maybe it's not necessary to have this all the time, otherwise you wouldn't be here.
Yes, exactly.
To speak to us. So
But I always remember it when I read this word here, I'm terrified, because it was terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, except that now he is able to bear.
Yes, I'm terrified. This transformation has come, and now there's no, in no part of the being is there any resistance. So I think that's where we stopped reading. When we were reading the canto, we just read this, am I right? That we just read this first section? Oh no, we read the next section also. Yes, okay. So let's go on with that. Don? Yeah?
As one who sets his sail towards mystery shores, driven through huge and self and selflessness, transgressing the dream shores of conscious mind.
Well, we know what eternal means, and the sempi bit is from Latin semper, which means always. So it's a kind of what's the word? Intensification of the word eternal. Semper is always.
There's an American military group which says semper fidelis.
Yes, or forever faithful. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Space, how if we look out into outer space, there's the field of the stars. We see them at night, we see some of them at night. It seems unconscious, blind. So this is a wonderful way of describing the universe. He's moving beyond the material universe. His soul is leaving the material universe. Yes.
I don't quite understand what you said, but in reference to what was just said, blind star field, that is to say...
Space, space. So we look out into outer space, all those blind stars. They're giving us light, they represent something. But with
was just reading something to the meaning.
Yes.
And the meaning was talking about Wordsworth.
About Wordsworth. Yes.
And he's driven through huge oceans by the breath of God. It's just the same rhythm that we find in him when he talks about the fastness that Hebrew is, or the
fields of sleep.
Yeah.
Rhythm.
Would you please speak also a little bit louder for us?
That's what I
ask.
It's very difficult to hear.
Sorry.
When one's expressing something deep, sometimes it's difficult to put it out with full volume. Anyway, it's this first sentence here, these first four lines, they are continuing Aswapati's journey, no? In this state of trance, he's like somebody in a little sailing boat setting off. He doesn't know where he's going, no? He's being driven through huge oceans by the breath of God. That's what is driving him, carrying him on his journey. There's a line like that in Book 1, Canto 4, where the traveller through time is carried across the oceans by the breath of the mother. So that's what Marco was pointing out, is that this line 120 has a particular rhythm which Nolini in a talk has associated with some lines of the poet Wordsworth, the English poet Wordsworth, which Sri Aurobindo identified as having some kind of overmental touch, you know, through that comes through the rhythm. So the fathomless, what is so deep it has no bottom, it cannot be measured, the unknown around, his soul abandoned. It moved beyond the limits of the material universe, the blind star field space. It goes very far away from all this world, which is measured in time and space. It's going beyond the manifestation. It's plunging, diving very deep to hidden eternities. It draws back from this foaming, bubbling surface of the mind to the vast spaces deep within us, in omniscient sleep. There's so much sleeping there within us, but those vasts don't speak. They are in a state of all-knowing sleep deep within us. So that is where Aswapati is plunging in now.
I wonder why he makes eternity plural. I thought there was only one eternity.
There are probably many planes of eternity. So it's deep, it's also above, far beyond the imperfect reach of word and thought, those vasts, no? He goes beyond our physical sight, that seeking, that can't see unless there's some form to see, that needs the support of form. It even gets lost, wanders in deep tracts, areas, territories of superconscient light, light of the higher consciousness, vast eternities, countries. It also travels through blank, featureless nothingness, all alone in that trackless incommensurable. He used this word in Canto 1 to express the unknowable reality, incommensurable, that can't be measured against anything. It's beyond all measures. He's in that state of measurelessness, so there are no tracks, there are no reference points, no ways of finding your way, no directions even.
this not self and self and selflessness.
Yes, he goes beyond.
And self would be like nirvana, the end of the mind. And then self would be like purushottama, beyond that. But then selflessness is what?
If somebody is selfless, we mean, or they are not self-centered, they are free of ego. Yeah. But these are states, no, that he's passing beyond these states on which we can put labels, self and not self and selflessness. He goes into some other kind of state, no?
When the transforming happened, already he has gone through it. Again, he's like.
Now he's going beyond those experiences. All those.
Like all these things still.
These are things that he can only reach by, states that he can only reach by plunging deep within our total being. These vasts, these voiceless vasts are there. So he transgresses, he crosses over the dream shores of conscious mind. And at last, after all that voyaging and wandering of the soul in inexpressible states, he reached at last his sempiternal base. He really comes to a state that seems stable.
This word transgress, it usually means to do something bad, no?
Yeah,
here it means just crossing?
Yes, that's the original root meaning of the word. It means to pass beyond, or pass across. So when we say somebody has transgressed, we mean, oh, they've gone beyond the bounds of proper human behavior. They've committed something very wrong. But that's a derivative meaning of the word. If we go back to its simple root meaning, it just means to cross beyond.
Is that bad?
You know, these words may be very close in meaning, but there's a difference in flavor. He could have perhaps written transcending here, but he's always looking for the inevitable word, the word that's perfectly right in that place. And this is the word that he's found here, transgressing.
I have an idea.
Yes.
Wouldn't the conscious mind feel that it's being transgressed?
Yeah, maybe. Yes, but maybe. Yeah. Yes, Sergei.
Soul in the darkness. Soul in the earth.
Sorry?
Line 1, comment 31.
Yes.
Soul in the darkness. Soul in the earth.
No. Soul here, S-O-L-E, means all alone. All alone in that state where there's nothing to measure anything by, no? There's no tracks. He's all alone in those immensities. Yeah. So this is now really an arrival. No? He reached at last his sempiternal base. So what is the experience?
Find your access, your cause, your right to you. Then only brings the spirit's motionless power, poised in itself to extinct eternity and its omniscient and omnipotent peace.
Thank you. It's one of the long sentences, yeah. There are a few sentences like that have 9 or 11 lines. Yeah. This is one of them. That's more than 20 lines, isn't it? Yeah. So that's, this is to try to help us understand this sempiternal base, what that experience is like. Yes, it's paradoxical. Sri Aurobindo is often giving us these opposites together to buffet our minds. He says, thought buffeted wakes up. So.
What is
eon? Eons are immensely long stretches of time. So that laborer, the mother who is laboring through the eons here in this state, she is at rest. There's this idea of the of nature just as a machinery, no? Like a clockwork toy. You turn the key and wind it up and then it just runs. Is our creation like that? A keyed creation just running around in the emptiness of space. This giant mechanism which is just being observed by the Purusha. No? This huge machinery that's being turned by fate, by some kind of predeterminism. No? It's not like that.
Like this, he's experiencing all these things?
Well, again, Sri Aurobindo is trying to convey to us what Asvapati experienced in that highest state. And the best way he could find is by these saying what it is not like, because we wouldn't be able to grasp if what, this makes it more concrete, more easy for us to understand. No? But that sense that nature, that the universe might be a machinery, that's gone completely. And even that sense of there being a universe, he's beyond that, no? So all the things that characterize our experience of the universe, he lists in this long, long sentence.
Why is this used, this terms,
But our universe is turning. Everything in our universe is turning. It's turning like an immense clockwork with gears and cogwheels and,
individual, what is it?
It's the image of a clockwork toy. You wind it up with a key, or a clock itself, you know, one of those old mechanical clocks.
Yeah.
Now we have clocks that we don't need to wind up, but... For 500 years, the clocks, you had to wind them up. All kinds of machinery that winds up the spring, and then everything just unrolls. No?
Like the toys.
Small toys, yes. Nowadays, they don't even have keys. No, they just put batteries in and you press a remote. But that idea that the universe might be like that, a vast clockwork. God has just wound it up and set it going, and now it's running like that, like a huge machine. Yes, but it's not entirely predictable. No, it really isn't, Don. The unpredictable is always happening. So he lists these things which we can recognize. No? In our world, in our world of duality, we can't separate evil from good. And even within one breast, they are both cohabiting there, the potential for what we call good and what we call evil. And in the very clasp of love, when we are most feeling love for a person, still there can be friction, clash of strife, in the very clasp of love. This dangerous pain of the kind of life that we are leading or being led by, which seems to be an experiment, trying out what will happen, all the different possibilities of inconsequence and chance, just the opposite of the fate-turned huge machinery. Life is always facing us with surprises, and it's even dangerous because it's dangerous and painful.
Like the sentence, evil and good, within one breath, like it is a reality, it means that it can be separate or it will always be there in one place. It means it should be transferred or it should be.
Even these two values depend on each other. What we say is good depends on what we think is evil. So in our consciousness, these things are not separable. It's like hot and cold. In fact, they form one whole. They're just different extremes of a spectrum of something that is heat, cold, no? That's the problem with dualities. So if you choose one thing, if you choose to be only good, somehow you will be doing evil. It will come out of it, you know. It can't be avoided. The two things go together. These poor Taliban, no? They're trying just to be good. Look at all the evil they are doing. And that's what's so dangerous, no? If we try to separate, we can't do it.
In the transformation, all these things I'm telling
the. Well, in the transformation, when we go into this new consciousness, even these values change. It's not, we don't say evil and good anymore. Shobindo's written about this. No? We just see the action of the divine and the action of the forces of nature. This whole definition of what is evil and good and what is pain and pleasure. It belongs to a particular time in the evolutionary process when consciousness is beginning to evolve and it hasn't evolved fully. When we get to that stage of what Asvapati has reached now, these things simply don't exist anymore.
Only this phenomenon, it is said that he only thinks all these things are there, but he's not being attaining.
Maybe he's not seeing them. Sri Aurobindo's describing these things to tell us what Asvapati is not experiencing. He says they were not there. They had, what does it say at the bottom? In that realm, they find no access, no cause, no right to live. They are simply not there. There only reigns the spirit's motionless power, poised in itself through still eternity in its omniscient and omnipotent peace. That's what Asvapati is experiencing. All these other things have totally ceased to exist for him, for this, the time of this experience.
So it's an end of duality. If you could get that omnipotent peace, you'd be free of all this good and evil, etc.
Yes, in your consciousness. We won't be free of it in practice until the whole earth is transformed.
In Thoughts and Aphorisms,
yes.
there is this beautiful passage of Sri Aurobindo that says, you took out my robe of evil and I rejoiced it was happening. Then you try to take out also
my robe of virtue.
Of virtue, and I didn't want. I was so nice like that, and only when you take out
my force,
I realized my soul.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. But we have to be careful with these things. You have to really, genuinely have the experience.
But in this case, at the same time, the terror is there.
Yeah.
To lose something.
Yes.
To lose that.
So he's describing our world and contrasting it with what Aswapati is experiencing. So in this description from line 144 onwards, anybody has any questions about this description of our world?
Aren't we always, though, by now, conscious of our own this dichotomy of good and evil? And that when we feel very strongly about what is good, to question, there's always a question. Why?
Well, we should, Audrey. I doubt whether we always do it. When you're very, very convinced that something is the good thing to do, you may not be so ready to question it. We should be. We should be.
It's so obvious.
It's obvious from outside. We don't see people questioning it.
You know, that something is terrible. What is it that one thinks is so bad?
And you're sure to be carrying it in yourself.
Yeah.
But try telling that to somebody who's absolutely sure that what they are doing is right and what the other people are asking them to do is wrong. You will not be able to convince them.
Just what you said now, Audrey, and bringing our bowl with various religions and philosophies of the world, the peril of mind's gamble, throwing our lives at stake in a wager of indifferent gods. In other words, we are the ones that put the heavy stress on it. Yeah. You don't believe in this, therefore you're going to hell, and so on and so forth. There is the gamble.
I'm not sure exactly that these gods here have anything to do with religion.
They need to be religion, it can be any form of religion. Not even necessarily a problem. This is the right way, this is the way to do it. You don't do it that way.
Shabindo said, beware of the too indignantly righteous.
Yes.
What Audrey said about, you know, why do you think something is absolutely right? You know, I think that's a sign that you haven't got the
yes, but we can observe that around us. But as Sri Aurobindo's also pointed out in an aphorism, he says that God has given us the sense of sin so that we might progress, you know, and discern, and I forget how he puts it. But he says that man has cheated God by being very alert to the sins of others and blind to his own. So, so this is the problem.
And there's a very inherent danger in that I've observed recently, is that if you get too impassioned thinking somebody else is wrong, you also get stuck in that falsehood because your mind has gone over to them, you're occupied with them instead of the divine.
And you're feeding the forces of division rather than the forces of oneness and harmony.
Yeah, but there's a, I don't know whether it's conflict, but in living here, someone may be very passionate about something, and there's dead silence around them. No one shares their truth about what the person is saying, so there's no feedback of objectivity. I mean, there's no other way of looking at it.
I think there's a reason for this, Audrey. We shouldn't really digress too much, but when somebody is really very passionate, whatever you say to them, whatever feedback you give, will only be used to fuel that passion. So it is safer to stand back and not feed it. But anyway, these are all rules which may be practical and may be useful sometimes, but the real thing is to get beyond these states altogether. No. What we need is a transformation of consciousness. Until that transformation comes on our level with our means, we are not going to solve these things.
So we can't help each other.
Maybe there are other ways of helping. Silently.
I think if people say my truth,
or with
not the truth.
Yeah. Mm. Yes, Marianne.
Here, that there, in the top page 321,
yes.
There, the only laborer that gets, would that mean everything is complete and
he's moved into a state which is beyond the dynamism. The laborer is there, the one who labors, but the one who labors is at rest. He's experiencing the state of cessation, of total peace. No, he doesn't say it's not there. He says it's at rest.
The answer
comes to the next section. No clash, no war. Mm. So I don't want to move on to the next sentence today. Anybody still has a question about this long sentence? We started talking about the peril, no? And the wager. Mind wants, actually on the whole, is in favor of progress. But it's forced because it can't foresee, because it doesn't have full knowledge. It's always taking a gamble on what it believes in or on the evidence it has. And that's dangerous. That allows our lives to be played with by these gods who don't care about us as individuals at all. They use us as pawns, he says, or they play with us. So because of the imperfection of mind, we are to a certain extent at the mercy of these gods who don't care about our welfare.
Maybe I always wanted to know where could one find reading about the Zurich forces? Is there a book or something?
Yeah, there are some sections in Savitri where he speaks about these forces. But perhaps it's most helpful to find in his letters, because there he has explained in a way that has relevance to our lives. Yes, but that's what I was thinking about, you know, the gods in, we are pushed, no? Where is it? It's a gamble, yes. There's this chess play, no? And those gods are playing with dice. And what happens to us depends on the throw of the dice. Yes, they are just enjoying their play. They are just amusing themselves. We are the dice, or we... they don't care what happens to us. Or we are the... We are the stake. We are the ones whose fate gets decided by their play.
For me, the other point is, yeah, when he took out of the bleeding roots, he offered the space to the gods.
I think those are different gods. But the gods in general, they're cosmic powers. Yes. But essentially the gods are the ones who are working for the light. But there are all these little godheads who are not aware.
It's strange that he uses his word.
Indifferent.
Or actually the mind is the gambler, that's what it says.
Yes. The mind can't help taking chances all the time, no? But then we throw our lives as a stake, and that's what creates our fate.
One more line there. Where knowledge is a seeking ignorance.
Yes, here we are, the perfect example of it. We have a little knowledge, but it's nothing more than a seeking ignorance. And yet in life, Divine Sri Aurobindo says that's hopeful, because the ignorance is seeking and the knowledge is gradually increasing, the light is increasing. But it's a transitional stage, and we will have to go beyond this kind of seeking ignorance to real knowledge. So all these characteristics of our world, everything that makes for the error and pain, suffering, evil, falsehood, in that realm had no access, no cause. The cause of all that is ignorance, unconsciousness, no right to live. He's come into a space which is beyond all this, where there's only the Spirit's power, motionless, at peace, poised in itself, through still eternity. Omniscient, omnipotent, but still. We'll continue with that next time.
So you feel that we have finished this sentence? I'd like to go more deeply into it, at least the last part of it.
If you have anything to ask about it, Don, we still have time. No. So we can have another look next time. Yeah. Mother doesn't read any of these lines here. Whatever lines we have from this part of the this canto come from the second part, the house of the new creation, but we can hear one or two from there. Yeah.
The great word of it, where heartbeat of one soul. Diffusion was a flame discovery of God. All mind was a single harp of many strings. All life a song of many meeting lives. For worlds were many, but the self was one. This knowledge was now made a cosmos seed. This seed was cased in the safety of the light. It needed not a filth of ignorance. None was apart. None lived for himself alone. Each lived for God, in him and God in all. Each soulness inexpressibly held the whole.